Ecclesiastes chapter 3. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to break down, and a time to build up. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to mourn, and a time to dance. Time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek, and a time to lose. A time to keep, and a time to cast away. A time to tear, and a time to sow. A time to keep silence, and a time to speak. A time to love, and a time to hate. A time for war, and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. Over to Leo.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Tom, and it's a real pleasure to be here again with you on this chilly day. If you were to take a lunchtime stroll about half a mile east up to Bishopsgate, and if you were to look up to the top of the Latham and Watkins building as you did, you would see two big banners with these words printed upon them. Days and nights crash over me like waves. Days and nights crash over me like waves. It's a piece of art, part of the Art in the City movement. Perhaps you know some others. A piece of art by Isabella Martin called Keeping Time. And I wonder if you ever have that sense as well. Days and nights crash over me like waves. I wonder if you've ever been out in the ocean, out of your depth, and just left at the mercy of the winds and the waves as they crash over you. And I wonder if that's how you ever feel about time. Because time just sort of happens, doesn't it? You blink and you miss it. Here we are, the end of 2022. Last time I checked, I think it was still 2020. They say that the midpoint of your life is turning 40, which might be a bit alarming for some of you here. Although for those of you who are sitting there feeling smug, well, they also say that in terms of how you perceive your life, because time seems to go slower when you're young and quicker when you're old, well, the true midpoint of your life is actually age 21. W.H. Auden wrote of it well. In headaches and in worry, vaguely life leaks away, and time will have his fancy tomorrow or today. Well, it's Christmas, isn't it? It's here. Merry Christmas to you. It's the most wonderful time of the year, as they say, and it's nice, isn't it? St. Nick's never looks nicer than with the big tree up and the lights on. But as the lights get switched on, as the turkey gets eaten, I wonder if you feel there is a sort of poignance to it all. Another year is gone and you're not getting it back. Perhaps the Christmas lights come with a sting. Author Lana Moore, she writes of it and she describes how a wholesome holiday film makes viewers conscious of their own family's dysfunction. An empty chair at the dinner table inevitably calls attention to the person that used to sit there. It is the most wonderful time of the year, but perhaps it taunts us more than anything else. And the question for this lunchtime is, where does that sense come from? Why do we feel like that? Days and nights crash over me like waves. There's nothing we can do about it. Why do we feel like that? Why do we get that sting of nostalgia? Where does that dissatisfaction in life's inevitable passing come from? When the holidays are over, why do we feel so gutted? And what are we supposed to do as a result? Well, I'd love to take just the next few minutes having a look at this very ancient piece of literature in the book of Ecclesiastes to see what it has to say about our time and its passing. And there are two points I want to draw out from this passage this afternoon. And the first one is looking at this very famous poem in verse 1 to 9. And the first point is this: our time is meaningful, but momentary. Our time is meaningful, but momentary. It's a very famous poem, isn't it? I think it's probably one of the most famous parts of the Old Testament, actually. In fact, growing up, it was the only piece of the Bible that was on display in our house. We had this poem framed above the washing machine. I think a time for washing and a time for drying would be a nice addition, actually. I've been told that there was a song from the 1960s by the Byrds set to these words. But to be honest, I don't really care about ancient history very much. But it's most well known for being a poem read at funerals. I think that's because there is a legitimate nice sense to this poem, isn't there? There is something nice about it, and I think that is right. There is a time for things. There are appropriate times, times for working and resting, building people up and rebuking them, having fun and having difficult conversations. And they are meaningful times, says the poem. We should not resent them. We should not long for the times that have not been granted to us. We should accept the times we're given. And that is all a legitimate reading of the poem, I think. But I wonder if the poem works in another way as well. Have a look with me at the text. You'll notice that that question in verse 9, well, it sort of ends the poem if you ignore the subtitle. What gain is there in your toil? What gain has the worker from his toil? That is the question behind so much of the book of Ecclesiastes, actually. And that idea of gain, it's not just financial or material gain. It is gain over the fallen world, gain over the brokenness of life, gain over the seemingly random cruelty of it all, gain over death itself. And so that is the question which hangs over the poem. Is there any gain? And well, you'll have noticed that the poem, it lists all of these times. And you may well have noticed all of these times are arranged in couplets. I wonder if you noticed that all of the times cancel each other out. Verse 2, as an example, a time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. And so on and so forth until you get to the end. And what have you got at the end of the poem? What have you gained? Well, nothing. Actually, there's been no gain. It's a clever poem, really, a kind of double-edged sword. Yes, there is a time for everything, but understand that the times will pass away, and there will be no gain at the end. Doesn't that speak to the worlds that we live in so well? The first time I ever had to do a talk on this passage was back in 2017, and I commented about how President Trump, the new president of the United States, well, so much of what he had done since his inauguration was to simply undo what the Obama administration had done before him. Fast forward 5 years to 2022, we're halfway through Biden's presidency, and so much of what he has done has simply been to undo what was done before him. And of course, he won't be the last. Someone else will come along and do the same. And it's not just an American problem, is it? I recall the last time I spoke here at St. Nick's, we had a different prime minister and a very different looking budget. the times. They are not unmeaningful. They are meaningful times, but there is no gain. Our moments are meaningful. It is okay to enjoy them. It is okay to appreciate them. It is okay to see them as precious. But remember that they won't last. And so we get to the end of the poem, and we still have that question, don't we? Well, why do we get this sense? Why do we feel that this isn't right? We know nothing lasts, and yet it just doesn't sit right with us, does it? And well, the author of Ecclesiastes, the author of these words, he knows exactly what the problem is. Because he knows that there is, in fact, someone who stands behind the curtain pulling all of the strings. And in his mind, he's very clear on who it is. It is, in fact, God. I wonder who you would say God is. Perhaps you've got a very well thought through theology, or maybe just an optional choice, perhaps. God is nothing more than an intellectual exercise. Or perhaps a comforting idea when things get tough. Or perhaps like your great aunt who you hear from at Christmas, but you're happy to ignore the rest of the year. Well, the author of this book, he doesn't have anywhere near as small a view of God as that. And in fact, his view of God is very much our second point for this afternoon. Verse 10 to 15, our time is ordained by the eternal God. You see, I think it's quite easy to read verse 1 to 9 as a sort of expression of our own autonomy. We are the ones who choose our times. We are the ones who choose the time to keep and cast away, to be silent and to speak. But as we'll come to see, that is simply not the case. When you look at verse 10 to 15, it is quite clear that God is the agent doing everything. All of those times in verse 1 to 9, well, they are in fact ordained for us by the eternal God. Now, these verses, like the whole book of Ecclesiastes, really are quite tricky to understand. But as you read them, a very clear picture emerges from them. And that is the picture of small and fleeting and finite man compared to the everlasting, the eternal, the omniscient God. Man for whom there is, well, no gain in his toil, but God for who, in verse 14, well, whatever he does endures forever. I wonder if you've ever had that feeling of being very small. I'm sure you have. Perhaps out in the ocean or up in a mountain, or maybe just walking across London Bridge at rush hour. Well, that is exactly the picture that the author is trying to draw out here. We, humans, mere breaths in a world that is ordained by the everlasting gods. And yet, here's the key, I think. There is a very significant crossover between us and him. Have a look with me at verse 11. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart. We know that nothing lasts. We see it. We see it in the poem, but we see it in our lives. We know it, and yet we're never quite okay with it, are we? When the holidays are over, when the possessions break, it just doesn't seem fair. A couple of months ago, my wife and I had a big mirror delivered to our flat, a big 2 meter by about 1 meter mirror, and it came to us cracked, and it was terribly frustrating. We got on the phone and arranged for it to be replaced, for them to come and collect it and bring a new one, and after 2 months, they eventually did. Took the old one away, got the new one, it wasn't cracked, brilliant. Lent it up against the wall, didn't quite realize how front heavy it was, and a small gust of breeze launched the whole thing straight down. And within an hour of it being delivered, it was lying in smithereens in the communal bin outside. And it just doesn't feel fair, does it? Why do we get that sense? Well, here's the reason. Humans are specks with a sense of eternity. We know that there is something more. And we know that the fleeting experience of the world that we live in, it just isn't right, because it doesn't match up to that eternal sense which is written on our hearts. And why do we have that? Why do we have this longing for more? And why do we have this sense of eternity compared to our own frail bodies? Well, have a look at verse 14, the second half. God has done it so that people fear before him. God has done it so that we have a right understanding of just who we are and just who God is. One commentator describes it as the recognition that God is God and people are human. That is the biblical fear, an understanding of just how small we are and just how everlasting God is. People say God can't exist. If he did, then it would be clearer. He would make himself clearer. But how much clearer does it need to be that this vain, fleeting world isn't right? How much clearer does it need to be that we have a sense of eternity in our hearts, a sense which nothing in this world can match up to? How much clearer does it need to be that we feel the futility of the world because God has put a sense of eternity into our hearts? It's easy to be a little bit arrogant at times, isn't it, I think? When life is leaking away, when we feel shortchanged by the futility of the world, when that sense of eternity stings us in the nostalgia for what once was, well, we can get so frustrated at God. Why have you cheated me, God? Why have you taken what I deserve? But none of it is a careless mistake on God's behalf. It is so that we have a right view of ourselves and a right view of who he is. It's easy to be deluded into thinking that we are in control when things are going well. I am the captain of my own fate, we say, as we bring in the million-dollar client. I am the master of my own soul, we say, as we get the dream house, the dream holiday, the dream car. But isn't it in the moments that we see our frailty, the unfortunate accidents, the disappointing news, the hospital beds? Isn't it in those times that we have the clearest view of just how small we are? We are specks with a sense of eternity. Our time is ordained by the eternal Creator, the everlasting Lord. And well, I hope this doesn't lead you to feel too miserable. Perhaps it is tempting to, except that is quite clearly not where the passage goes, is it? Have a look with me at the verses I've completely leapfrogged so far, at verse 12 and verse 13. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. Well, it feels like a gear change, doesn't it? How do we respond to our fleeting time? How do we respond to our hours which evaporate every single second? Well, we enjoy the gifts that God has given to us. That is the correct way to respond to the fact that we are fleeting mortals, to accept the lot that God has given us with gratitude and thanks. Revere and rejoice. Understand your position before God and rejoice in what he has given to you. There is a time for everything. It won't last, but enjoy it. Your time is ordained, so give thanks for it. It's difficult to hold those ideas together, I think, isn't it? How are we supposed to be thankful for our days when they are numbered? Why is it that there is nothing better than to rejoice in our work, even though it is fleeting? Well, I think the point is because we have it as a gift, because it has been given to us by the eternal Creator. And every single gift that we have, every breath that we draw, well, it is a reminder that there is an eternal Creator who is working behind the scenes. There is one behind the curtain, ordaining everything, and we can trust him. Even in this vain world, there is an omnipotent God still ordaining everything, and every gift we have is a sign of that. And so, the author of Ecclesiastes says, you can enjoy those gifts. You are free to enjoy them. Not because they are eternal and not because they bring gain, but they are a sign of the one working who can. You see, the Christian never needs to lament about the passing of time because it only ever reminds us of our position before an everlasting God. And he is an everlasting God who we can trust. Enjoy the gifts that God has given you. That is the wise way to live in this fleeting world. To realize just who we are, to realize who God is, and to give thanks to him for every gift he gives. You see, the Christian has no real cause to despair at the relentless march of time because we trust the one who is in control of it. As another Christmas comes and goes, well, we continue to trust in the Lord who ordains every single day because he is working in all things. And just as we receive every gift from his omniscient hands, we can trust that his omniscient hand is working in all things. It is perhaps easy from this passage alone to mistake God for being distant, but that is not true. The same God who omnisciently ordains our time is the one who walked this earth 2,000 years ago so that he might be made known. You see, the world hasn't changed for Christians. We still live in a crooked world, and you don't need me to tell you that. We are still small and fleeting. Our moments are momentary, and well, we feel the sting of life leaking away. And yet, the Christian, well, they know the God who ordains it all, and they can trust him. We can trust that he guides us through our moments, and he loves us. And when one day we meet him, he will welcome us as a friend. Days and nights crash over me like waves. And yet we have a king who spoke to the waves, and he told them to be still, and they were. And his name is Jesus. Well, please allow me to close with just a final prayer. Father, as we are daily reminded of the vanity of the world, may we trust in you who stands above it all as the eternal Creator. May we give thanks for every gift you give us. And as we receive every one, may we see it as a sign that you are working to bring all things under the lordship of Jesus. We trust in the day to come when Jesus will restore all things. And until then, Father, we await that with joy, knowing that you are working, and we trust that everything is according to your plan. May that be true as we go out this afternoon, and may we be people who know this peace, who know the joy of trusting in you as life leaks away. I pray that for all here, And I pray it all in Jesus' name. Amen.